sun, little darling. Here comes the sun. I say it's all right. It's all right.
Hey, Nina. Hey, everybody. This is Eric Mann. I'm the host of Voices from the Front Lines, your national movement building show. You're on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Thank God we have this station, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Hello, Mindy and Hank. And streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. Also, we have a terrific website which we would love you to register on. www.voicesfromthefrontlines.com. If you go on there and you register, you get a weekly bulletin, usually on Tuesday, sometimes Monday morning, about what the show is going to be about, coming attractions that you could send to your friends. And as other people have said, don't get discouraged, Eric. We are out there, so I appreciate it. You can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks. You can Facebook me, I think, at Eric Mann Speaks. And you email me at eric@voicesfromthefrontlines.com, and I'll read the stuff the following week. So the main thing we're doing today, folks, is we're talking about film, or what I'm calling white folks films. And as I say in the email that we sent out, because some of my best friends are white. Now, the four films that we're going to review, that I'm going to review today, is Grandma, Mississippi Grind, I'll See in My Dreams, and The Age of Adeline. I'm reviewing those four because those are the four I saw with my wife Leanne over the last 10 days. I've been trying to watch more film. None of these are really great films, although I would say Mississippi Grind is a pretty serious, important film, and Grandma's got some redeeming qualities. But I love talking about film. I know a lot of you do. I want to do it more. I've lost that loving feeling, and I want to get back to it. And sometime in the show, soon, I'm going to have my friend Gary Stewart, who is one of the founders of Rhino Records, who he and I do our frickin' frack on films. We've known each other for a long time, you know, sort of two Jews on film, so it should be good. So the first thing I want to talk about is, and I mean this very seriously, why I'm calling it white folks films. I think you know that in the United States it's pretty strange that the concept of whiteness, which I certainly reject, assumes it's the norm. So, for instance, when Straight Outta Compton did well, everybody said, see, there's much more of an audience for black films than you think. And, in fact, demographics show that 37% of the people that watched this black film were white. So it's assumed, whether it's Selma, whether it's 12 Years a Slave, we assume they're black films. And there's nothing wrong with that. But when there's a film with all these white folks in it, they don't say, this is a really good white film. Like, they don't say, best actor in a leading role in a white film. They don't say, best director in a white film. It's assumed by white people and by the dominant culture that film is white. Therefore, it's redundant to say white. But that's really important because I'm a Jewish man. I've lived in the, you know, in the black community for 50 years, worked in the black community for 50 years, and I do see things primarily through a black lens. Most of the faces I see in front of me are black. Most of my friends are black. Most of the books I read are black. So I don't generally hang around, or never really hang around, in public, significantly white, let alone vast majority white context. And when I do, I'm shocked at how white people just sort of assume this is normal, where to me it looks kind of bizarre. So I did see four films this week that I was going to review, and I'm going to review. They're all starring, and they virtually all have all white casts, all white leads. So I just wanted to start by saying that they're white films. But then I just wanted to, before I go into the white films, the white folks films, just develop this a little bit more, because it's not inherently that it has to be this way. You know, there's like on television, there was a show many years ago called 30-something. It was kind of one of the first yuppie, touchy-feely TV shows. It was produced by Marshall Herskovitz, who was starring Timothy Busfield, white, Mel Harris, White, Peter Horton, Ken Olin, and Patricia Wedig White. And they were being interviewed. And interestingly, somebody said to them, how come everybody in the show is white? And this was, fortunately, I think, a white interviewer. And without realizing what they were saying, which was great because they didn't have the censor on, one of the producers says, well, most white people don't have any black friends. And I thought, wow. Sadly, that's true. Not for everybody, but that is true. But you would justify that? I mean, you couldn't think of writing black people into the script because you wanted to be quote realistic? Why don't you just call it, you know, 30 Klansmen, you know, instead of 30-something? So I know for black folks, you know, this is so infuriating and so normal, and we got to sort of, you know, they often say to me, Eric, please talk more about it because we're just tired of talking about it. We don't want to talk about white folks. We don't want to talk about white racism. We don't want to talk about it. But it needs to be talked about, especially to just accept that there is a white society that sees the things through a white lens. Now, not every show, contrary to what 30-something said, there's another show called Friends, or what I call it, White Friends. I mean, I call it, oh, let's watch White Friends tonight. The White Friends are Jennifer Aniston, Courtney Cox, Lisa Kudrow, Matt LeBlanc, Matthew Perry, David Schwimmer. What do they all have in common? They're friends, and they're white, but they should call it White Friends. Then there was also White Seinfeld. But coming out of White Seinfeld, there's a show that I would not call white, which is called Curb Your Enthusiasm, also by Larry David, who, yes, is white, and is Jewish. I think he's done a great job for a white guy who's the lead in a show to bring real black characters, strong black characters, into his show and to deal with white racism in a very, very effective, as I'll get to, way, proving that, no, it's not inherent that all white people have no black friends, and some white people got a lot of black friends. But before I get to Curb Your Enthusiasm, there was one more thing I wanted to talk about, which is this horrible, horrible show called It's All in the Family, which for those people more my age, you might have seen it when it first came out. It's been on forever. And for a lot of the younger people, I hope you don't see it, but it's on endless reruns. It's All in the Family was written by Norman Lear, who is a liberal, a white liberal in Hollywood. What people don't understand is why we in the 60s hated white liberals. White liberal was not a good word. And It's All in the Family is a perfect example of the profound racism of white liberalism. In It's All in the Family, the lead, of course, is Archie Bunker, who's a, first of all, a caricature of the white working class. So it shows the real contempt for the white working class that the white Hollywood crowd, white left liberals, you know, Beverly Hills types have. So Archie Bunker is a white working class guy, and he's got, you know, a more liberal son-in-law who he calls Meathead, Rob Reiner. And first time I saw the show, I was sick because I got it right away. They're trying to ridicule Archie Bunker for being a racist, but they're letting him say racist things, horrible racist things. Hey, Arch, don't say that. You're a meathead. You're a meathead. Guess what? Who was the most attractive character on the show? Archie Bunker. Archie Bunker was not perceived to be a racist. He was perceived to be a cool guy who said, which Donald Trump is now showing, that when a white guy tells it like it is and says horrible racist things, there's virtually no consequences. So Norman Lear, real, you should be ashamed of yourself and all those white liberals from Hollywood who love It's All in the Family. It shows the contempt you have for white working class people, the stereotypes, and how much you allowed and wrote into the script that a racist becomes the lead. And let me tell you, he's a very attractive lead. He's not somebody you hate. Which brings me to Larry David, because Larry David is doing something totally different from what Norman Lear did. He is really making a white racist look ugly. And the way you got him do that, of course, duh, is to have black people in the show. You can't have white people arguing about why Archie Bunker is a racist. Now, if you've ever watched Curb Your Enthusiasm, one of the great, great accomplishments of this show is Larry David really, really makes you hate him makes you cringe. He's like the guy around, oh, God, no, no, oh, God, you're not really going to do this. No, no, oh. And his wife, Cheryl Hines, you know, she does love him. He is at times lovable, but he is unbearable. And the show is all about his self-destructiveness, his narcissism, and to the degree Larry David grasps that, he does a really good job of exposing it. But more importantly, he has black characters who expose it. So the first thing is he didn't just hire a black actor, but he hired Wanda Sykes. Now, if you know Wanda Sykes, well, you don't do white racist things on the show and think she's going to get away with it. He's going to get away with it, either from Wanda Sykes or the character that Larry David helps her play. So when he does things, she says, oh, God, Larry, you are a racist. She doesn't say you did something racially insensitive. She doesn't even say what you did was racist. She says, Larry, you are a racist. And she calls him on it in a way that in case the white left liberals from Beverly Hills don't get it, but they do, she nails it. And then there was a great thing he does where, I forget the pretense, but they, quote, adopt a black family, maybe from New Orleans, from Katrina, I forgot what the pretext was, starring J.B. Smoove, who's now moved on to be a very, as you know, very big player. And the dynamics between the two of them for an entire season at least is where you had both Wanda Sykes and J.B. Smoove as strong black characters. And in one of the all-time great lines is when black people occasionally want to say something to a white person they like, they will say, you're my, and they'll use the N-word affectionately without the R, with the A-H, which I never use in either context. So when Larry is trying to give a real compliment to J.B. Smoove, he says, you know, man, you're my Caucasian. Yeah, you're my Caucasian, brother. I thought it was one of the great lines on television. Okay, so the context of all this is I'm going to tell you about four films. I am. And those four films are all in a white context. So here I go. Now, the first film is called Grandma. It's starring Lily Tomlin, Julia Garner, and Marsha Gay Harden. It's directed and written by Paul Weitz. So in Grandma, Lily Tomlin is an older academic lesbian. We see a picture of a longtime partner who died, it turns out a black woman, and she's presently having an affair with a younger woman that she's breaking off out of what seems like a self-destructive bitterness. Along comes her granddaughter, Julia Garner, who informs her that she's pregnant and wants to have an abortion. The rest of the film is a road movie. I like road movies, not Thelma Louise quality, but a journey of an older woman going through old relationships to find $600 to fund the abortion. Now, the fact that abortion is considered a viable option is in itself a good thing. Really, the question is that we accept, and the daughter accepts, that she really wants to have an abortion. There's also references to Simone de Beauvoir and Betty Friedan and the feminine mystique. The point is that this has a feminist sensibility in which it's one of the ways she's trying to get money for an abortion is selling copies of the feminine mystique. And she's not doing very well in terms of getting money for it. But it does bring in Lily Tomlin as sort of an older lesbian feminist out of the feminism of the 60s, from which I come in many ways, and certainly in this case, the white feminism of the 60s, but very nicely done. Lily Tomlin is a very attractive and compelling figure on screen. Lily Tomlin never tries to play beautiful, but she actually is very beautiful, a very smooth face, and yet attracting and compelling figure on a screen. I think you know if you watch film that one of the things I'm always struck by is whose face do I want to see for a long time? And as I'll get to in some of this, there's a few people like Blythe Danner whose face, frankly, I didn't really want to see for 2 hours. But Lily Tomlin holds the screen really, really well. In some ways, she's like a movie star. I don't know if any of you can remember her as Ernestine, the telephone operator on Laugh-In, and I remember Goldie Hawn as well. And, of course, The Search for Intelligent Life in the Universe. And the new one, Grace and Frankie on Netflix, she plays Frankie with Jane Fonda, in which she sort of plays a stoner, a love child, as both women find out that their husbands are gay. Now that, Grace and Frankie, much better, in my opinion, than Grandma in terms of the complexity of the writing, the complexity of the character development. But it is what it is. We'll get to that. So Lily Tomlin goes through many old friends and lovers, one of whom is Sam Elliott, playing Sam Elliott. Very handsome, without his classic mustache, great deep voice. And the plot is that Lily had an abortion of a child she had with Sam many years ago without telling him, only later have a daughter with a man she did not care about. Now, the scene between the two of them is very moving. You wouldn't think that she, once upon a time, was heterosexual, at least for a moment, and that the two of them were old lovers. Now, in the film, Marcia Gay Harden plays the mother, who was Lily Tomlin's daughter, of that casual affair. In my opinion, a caricatured super career woman too busy to take care of her granddaughter, and only the last person they would go to for money after every other effort bursted out. Then the last scene, all three women reconcile. Very formulaic U.S. family theory. That first you show the great dysfunction of all throughout the film, but then somehow in the end, folks come to terms with things. Then Lily Tomlin goes back to her young girlfriend to apologize for being so mean, and then walks off alone into the sunset. So, hey, everybody, you can start tweeting me at Eric Mann Speaks. I'm going to read you a couple of tweets because I just want you to know I do get a few. From Black Cat says, Eric Mann Speaks, why are Ian Masters not on today and you have to get 2 hours? See, isn't it wonderful when people love you? The first time we do a two-hour special about Katrina and the late Julian Bond. The answer is because it was a great show. I hope you really loved it. And then, very nice, from Jonathan Stiss, what a beautiful interview with Julian Bond inside the Civil Rights Movement, a conversation with Julian Bond. Very nice. Jonathan Stiss is with the Association of Educational Justice. Clay Carson and Rich Wessenberg followed you. Very nice. Zero Badillion, looking forward to the Eric Mann Speaks column. Honey Vibe, favorite a treat with you, we're mentioning. Nola, like biowarfare blankets hit Native Americans. Lead Edge of Warfare seems to hit Chocolate City like blowing blankets hit Native Americans. Jake Council and two others followed you. So, thanks. That's cool. Manuel Criollo, Memphis BRU, thank you so much. And we got a very nice retweet from Julian Bond's sister. So at Eric Mann Speaks, you can say, why even on for 1 hour? I'll just take any tweet I can get. Okay? Now we're going to move to the next film. In Blythe Danner, I'll See in My Dreams. Blythe Danner plays a lonely older woman, very classically beautiful, tall, statuesque, but very sad and only, and sort of what I call low-grade depression. She hangs around with three other women, Rhea Perlman, who I think you know from Cheers, among other things, June Squibb, whose career has gotten new life from Nebraska, from the film Nebraska, and Mary Kay Place, who I should know more of her credits, but she's a very, very fine actress. So these are four older women's. Now, there's a big scene in where her dog dies, and as the vet is giving him some last rites, he asks if she would like some time with him before he puts her down, and there's a allegedly moving scene where she says goodbye to her dog. I didn't find it very moving. She then meets a handsome man played by Sam Elliott, who apparently is still feeling jilted by Lily Tomlin from the Grandma film. They fall in love, and then he dies. She gets into a weird relationship with a flat-as-a-board pool guy, Lloyd, and they have a spring-September friendship that is neither sexual nor friendly, but dull, dull, dull. Then she ends up finding a new old dog and drives off into the sunset. So I guess the new old dog is supposed to symbolize that she's an old dog and he's cute, the dog, and she lost her husband. Then she lost Sam Elliott, and that was sad a little bit, like you meet a cool guy and he drops dead. Really, it's not funny. I mean, the implication being that older people drop dead, as younger people do too, but the fragility is after 20 years she finally lets down her guard and finds somebody she likes, and he actually proposes to her. And they do make love, which is very nice, and then he's gone. But I would say in this one that, well, we're going to get to some of my conclusions at the end, but very frankly, who cares? I mean, this was, you're talking about people I could not find an ounce of empathy with or connection with. This was really a bad film, in my opinion. I know it, and they had all these close-ups of her face, which I didn't think she was looking real good, in my opinion. I thought Lily Tomlin looks much better. You know, Blythe Daniel, we get it, is classically beautiful. Her daughter is whatever her name is, some jerk. Isn't that funny? I forgot her name. But Lily Tomlin looked great. Okay, so that film, no, I wouldn't urge you to see it, but go see it. What do you know? Now, the next film is called The Age of Adeline. Now, Blake Lively, who is super gorgeous, she's a very gorgeous woman who looks much like Blake Lively, who through a miraculous set of circumstances has an accident that prevents her from aging a day after 29, which is when this accident happened, this set of, she falls in the ocean and freezes, and theoretically freezes her growth hormones, and that's a film, but sure. So she lived for almost 100 more years. She has to move on from situation to situation, like the Harrison Ford fugitive film, only to find true love with a rich library patron. So she lets her guard down and agrees to spend a weekend with him and his family, which is a bizarre idea. I mean, since she's not even gone on a date for decades and is so withdrawn, when any woman says, would you like to go and meet my family or any guy, the answer is no. No, please. You know it's going to be hell. You know families have horrible times. They're all going to try to be friendly. Every family dinner scene in the movies, which I think is right, is painfully horrible. So, no, it makes no sense that you haven't seen anybody for 400 years, you're 29 years old, stuck in a time capsule, and you meet this guy, you finally let your guard down, and he says, oh, for the weekend, it's my parents' 40th anniversary, would you like to go? And she goes, sure, sounds like a lot of fun. Oh, come on. So there, before she gets there, there's a very moving scene where her dog of so many years dies. And the vet asks, I swear this is true, if she wants to spend time with him or her before he puts her down. Oh, is that the dog from the Blythe Danner film? Or the dog with Sam Elliott? I mean, I don't know why black people can't get any roles in films, but dogs get roles. Dogs even get dying roles now. We were in two straight films. There's these deep films about saying goodbye to your dog. No, I'm not a big supporter of PETA. I like the bread, but not the group. And the concept of, we can't get any black people in a film, but I said, if you're an agent, I guess it's better to represent dogs. So there she meets, what a shock, Harrison Ford, who's the guy's father, who apparently has run away from being a fugitive, and who immediately recognizes her since he was her last love 40 years ago before she ran away, rather than tell him of her eternal youth. As if some guy would hate that the woman you're going out with is 29 years old and says, I'm going to be 29 for the rest of my life. Oh, God, well, I definitely have to run away. But when Harrison Ford sees her, and now remember, she's 29. She's always been 29. He makes a fool of himself in front of his wife and family. Acts like a psychotic lech. I mean it. And she tells him that, he says, well, I know you, I know you. She says, well, actually, that person you know, that was my mom. Now, why? She pulls that story as ridiculous, but it's also as ridiculous as why did she even go to the 40th anniversary anyway? So after several zigs and zags, both he and his son find out that she's the same person. And Harrison Ford, in this horrible, horrible hokey film, gives the keys to the car to his son to chase her down. Go get her, son. They do reconnect. She has another accident and is shocked back to life. And then finally, as we find out, the aging process, the wonderful aging process, begins. The film's most moving, somehow chilling scenes are when Blake Lively's daughter, played by Ellen Burstyn, of the great 1974 film Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. Now, that's a white people's film in another stratosphere of the films discussed here. So, Ellen Burstyn is physically old enough to be her grandmother, and she still loves her mom. But the idea that she slept with both the father and the son, and they're both so happy about it, gives me the creeps, but hey, at least Blake Lively is a pleasure to watch, and for $4.99 on DirecTV, it was exactly worth the price. Hey, Gary, how you doing?
Good to be here. I'm here from the Norman Lear Fan Club.
Good. Good. Well, we're going to get into that. That's right. No problem.
You need to see better movies.
Oh, this is not good movies.
Okay.
This is only four I've seen. So they're being reviewed because I wanted to talk about films, not because these are good films. All right, the last one. See, Gary's here already.
By the way, any film you see, in my mind, is a good film if you think about it and have a reaction. There's no such thing as a bad experience.
That's correct, Gary. That's deep. You're a deep guy. So the last one, which is the most interesting of the four films, Mississippi Grind is a road movie of two gambling addicts played brilliantly by the dashing Ryan Reynolds and Ben Mendelsohn. The most moving scene is when Ben Mendelsohn goes back to visit his wife in Little Rock with Robin Weigert in a great tiny role. He's a gambling addict. He's lost. The two of them are very attracted to each other. That is to say, Ryan Reynolds and Ben Mendelsohn, two losers of different types. And he says, I'm just going to go back to see my family in Little Rock. This is after he's lost all this money. But there's a scene of Ben trying to steal money out of his wife's drawer. He says, I want to go to the bathroom. She says, sure. She lets him in. And then she sees him in her bedroom because he knows that she keeps money in the drawer. It is so painful and disgraceful. If there's anything that exposes what an addict is, and yes, I had a drug addict friend steal money out of my drawer. It's done well. There's a short scene with Alfre Woodard as the caring bookie, the good cop, backed up by body breakers. She should have gotten much more. She's such a talent. She has a little scene where they're sitting at the deli. You know, at first you don't even know what the relationship. Hey, Jerry, how you doing? Good, good. Well, what's up with what? Oh, yeah, I'm going to get you the money. I'm going to get you the money. No, when? I really need it, Jerry. Oh, no, no, no. How's the family? Good, good, good. Well, Jerry, you know, do you want me to send Louie? No, no, no. Don't send Louie. Don't send Louie. Okay, okay, good. Well, hey, have a good day. Yeah. And he gives her $60. She goes, no, you keep it, Jerry. I know you're going to get me the money. I thought it was really good because you have all the stereotypes of the hard-ass bookie, and she was so sweet. Because she was going to break his neck the next day, and both sides knew it. Wish there would have been more to that scene, because I think she pulled off that cameo, I guess it's called, really beautifully. Both with Robin Weigert, Miss Woodard, and Sienna Miller as Ryan Reynolds' prostitute girlfriend, the women's roles were actually well cast and very well written, but clearly, and meant to be, completely secondary to the sick male bonding of the two addicts. So the men didn't see women as very serious, you know, so that was sort of appropriate in the writing. The film ends with both men making money. After tons of backs and forth of winning, losing, winning, with Ben Mendelsohn seeing a picture of his daughter with the hope of bringing those winnings home to her to make things right. And Ryan Reynolds calls his girlfriend to ask her to come with him to Machu Picchu, this hypothetical place he's going to go to. But we're not clear if she will come. We also know, and this is one of the strengths of the film, that this is really not the end of the film. Both men may piss away the money, double or nothing, in the next scene, after the film ends. There's no reason to believe they will quit while they're ahead. There's no reason to believe he's going to give the money to his daughter. Okay, so a few last thoughts. I think the real problem is not just that they're white people's films, but they're part of the broad kind of cultural catastrophe of individualism in our society, in which, yes, white culture is an important reflection, but imperialism is the more structural problem. In every film, it's not just a film about white people, but white people in the U.S. alone. No community, no family, no personal dynamics. All the lonely people, the Eleanor Rigby. In the end, very frankly, I don't care about any of them very much because they don't care about me. They don't care about the people with whom I work, black people. They have no values. None of them. And also, they can't carry on a conversation about anything. Where is dinner with Andre or dinner with anybody? The dinner scenes between women and men are boring as hell. Making eyes at each other, pathetic jokes, a small talk to try to create an artificial chemistry. Not one interesting idea in any of these films. This is really, to me, the collapse of imperialism, not just in the racism of its casting, but the pathos of white life and the end of the collective vision of community, politics, ethic, global warming, anything but me, me, me. So, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Frontlines. I'm completely right, and now we're going to listen to Gary, who's going to say a few things that are totally irrelevant or incorrect.
Well,
so happy to have you on the show.
Thank you for having me. And
let me tell everybody who he is. Okay. Of course, he is a very dear friend of mine. He worked at Rhino Records, a senior VP and A&R for 25 years. And was
iTunes for 7 years.
I'm going to get to that, dude.
I'm sorry.
Man, I'm going to give you more time. He worked at iTunes for 7 years. Gary's on the board of the Liberty Hill Foundation, advisory board of Los Angeles Alliance for New Economy, both are our friends. Quote, trying to balance the occasional pursuit of social justice with mind-numbingly opiating trips into pop culture indulgence. He's also a friend of the Strategy Center, and he's a friend of mine. Hey, Gary.
Good intro. Good intro. Thank you very much, and thanks for having me.
Of course.
I'm going to say a lot of things that
please
are wrong. Wait, they're going to be completely right. Where to start? First of all, I want to stand up for Norman Lear. I'm younger than you. I grew up watching All in the Family. I learned a lot about race and racism. The show was flawed. Looking through the prism of history, it maybe seems more condescending or erroneous in certain things. That's often the case when something takes on a subject first. Norman Lear had a lot of power. He might not have been as informed as somebody would nowadays, but nobody else was doing it. Let's also not forget the episode where Archie Bunker shows the admiration for Sammy Davis Jr., doesn't want him to kiss him, and does it's the most uncomfortable moment, sort of exposing the, you know, the double standard of we love entertainers, we just don't love intimacy with the people. That show also spawned spinoffs of the Jeffersons in Good Times. And Good Times was kind of a black honeymooners. It talked about people and projects dealing with a hard time. That wasn't something you saw on TV portrayed with any normalcy. Good Times, where did you see affluent upper class ascending from lower class mobile blacks in that upward mobility blacks as a center of a sitcom or any program, also first ever interracial relationship. I get your critique of him, but I think it's the people who are opposing the things we're trying to move forward on rather than the people that maybe get it a little underinformed or even clueless are the ones that are more problematic. So we won't spend the whole time talking
but
about Norman Lear.
Let me just rush about that.
Okay.
You say, but here's the thing. I've worked, as you have, but I've been in auto factories with white workers, I mean, who are very intelligent, often do have a lot of racial problems. I don't think in a racist society that you can say pretty much unchecked racist things so consistently. You may read them through a better lens. Obviously, some people felt, oh, ho, ho, I get it. This is a pun on racism. I get what the intent was. The intent was to lampoon racism, take it out of the closet, give it a complexity. There were rebuttals, but here's what I think. If you did a focus group and you took 1,000 white working people and said, what do you think of the show? I think too many would say, I love Archie Bunker. What a cool guy. And you say, well, what about the pun on racism? They say, what pun?
You're right. A lot of people at the time, I remember people saying, are people laughing at him or laughing with him? And plenty of people were laughing with him. It's a fair critique, but I think that show moved the dialogue forward. It might have been better if something else that was differently oriented or better informed came out. It did afterwards. And also, I think we need to give him credit for the legacy of things like Maude and the Jeffersons and Good Times, not to mention his work with People for the American Way.
Okay.
You know?
Next film.
We'll talk about your four films or the two that I've seen. I want to sort of talk about a little bit about context because I try to do a little research before coming here. I know you just talked to me today. And for me, by the way, great observation. We'll talk about that later, hopefully, about how those films are all about sort of individuals, a paucity, maybe not an absence, but a paucity of community. And I never thought about that. So I appreciate that. You know, last year there was a lot of controversy over Selma being largely not recognized in the Oscar nominations and the issues that brought about in terms of representing race in film and what was going on. And they tried to compensate by having more people of color as presenters or, you know, almost embarrassingly went out of their way. I don't know if you saw the Oscars to go right. Like, look, we're not like this. This year they're like, okay, we're honoring Spike Lee, which he completely deserves it. And I think you're probably going to see more variety. I think one of the two hosts is going to be a person of color, if not both of them. I think that's very likely. That's fine. But for me, at the time, everybody was talking about, like, should Selma have gotten it? Did they get snubbed? Just like, well, I don't know if it got snubbed. I liked that film a lot. I thought it was very, very good, great in parts. I wouldn't say it was great. I think the problem wasn't that Selma didn't get recognized. The problem was look at the larger context. Look at what you have to choose from. You know, you have like one or two films with people of color at their center. And for me, that's the larger problem. So the next thing I started doing today was looking at the pipeline. And, you know, I'm a film nerd, so I'm excited about what I'm reading about at the Toronto Film Festival or the Telluride. Venice, all these things that are going to be, you know, the Oscar films, the good films in the fall that are mind, you know, not mind-numbing films. I love mind-numbing films, by the way. Nothing wrong with that. And thinking, well, what's going to be different this year? I mean, I'm all excited about everything I'm reading about, but I'm thinking, like, you know, you're right, a lot of white people. So I tried to do some research of what films have non-white people in any key roles. I got a list. I don't recognize about half the titles. And, you know, and I'm a nerd, so I would. Here's what I see. Here's what you have. Maybe Straight Outta Compton has a shot at an Oscar or parts of it. Probably not likely for acting because no performance. You know, maybe the guys played Eazy-E did. That might get it. All I see, the possibilities are Concussion. That's Will Smith's movie about football injuries. Certainly they're trying for that. Sorry. And The Hateful Eight, the Tarantino film of Samuel Jackson. Beast of No Nation with Idris Elba. But not a lot. That's three in a C. So we'll talk about other things. But for me, it's important to talk about that kind of context in terms of availability. There's the demand, but where's the supply?
Well, one thing I want to say to our listeners and to my wife, Leanne, really, is one of the big true self-criticism I had is how hard I was on the film Selma. I missed the point. Film, in retrospect, I really liked the film a lot. And I was at the time, and I still am, that's not the main point, but just to, so I'm not hallucinating, I was very concerned about certain ways that I felt that the film put down either the more militant, more violent, in the good sense, armed self-defense, basically caricatured even some of the people in SNCC and so forth. All right, that was the point. But I really missed the point, and I mean that. First of all, it's very hard to make a political film that even has any life to it. I mean, I understand the so-called smaller people film are a lot easier to make. I mean, it's hard to make a film where the politics is really driving it. They, I think, did a great job around the character of King, but there was a lot of politics. And if you ask the average person, what was the politics? It wasn't just that the Southern racists, but it's that Lyndon Johnson was not the friend of black people that I thought. That's a big thing. And, of course, the liberals came down like a house of cards against that film. That's one reason. How dare you be ungrateful to Master Johnson? And I want to just say to the filmmakers, you know, I seriously apologize that I sort of said that, but not with the caring and clarity I should have. I said especially because I'm not just interested in black individualism. Of course, I'd like to be integrated, you know, integrate bourgeois alienation and integrate small films about, but most black people are very angry right now, and they are looking for films that try to express something collectively about the vision. That's hard as hell to do. And again, big props to Selma for, you know, I wish, where's the next one is my point.
Well, first of all, I liked Selma an awful lot. I said it was very, very good, not great. What I loved about it was that it didn't give the comforting Martin Luther King as a person of peace. Martin Luther King was a person of strategy and organizing. I love that film because these are the things I liked, but that it showed you how organizing worked. And it was like a war film.
That's right.
Even the strategy sentences were like war things. The confrontations with opponents were shot like war scenes. The visceral aspect of that and the sort of cerebral and the not willing to give you the comforting, you know, Martin Luther King was loved everybody's. No, he wanted to win. I love that. I thought it was a little flawed in moments of the wife saying, "Did you love me?" It sort of dipped into sentimental minor things. I give it like a B+, A-. Her previous film, by the way, Ava DuVernay's A Middle of Nowhere, great film about, you know, modern day middle class African American. As good, maybe I think better than Selma. Nobody went to see it. David Oyelowo is in it, is one of the leads. Terrific. We'll talk about that another time.
No, wait, that's important. Wait, you're listening to Gary Stewart. Gary, tell the name of the film. Slow it down.
It's called Middle of Nowhere. Middle of Nowhere.
Ava DuVernay.
Ava DuVernay's second film.
Okay,
I don't know
great.
What the first
Go
was.
On IMDb and check that out.
And, you know, it was a winner at Sundance.
Really?
It got released. It was an invisible LA Film Festival, made it a gala. I saw this and thought, like, this is going to get to that audience. And it was, it didn't ignore the situation, but it wasn't about just about drug dealing or crime. It had elements of those, but it was about somebody kind of having a a struggle in a middle-class existence.
Well, just in terms of freelancing and free thinking, is that the Strategy Center, we're very excited that we're going to be opening up an office at King & Crenshaw. We've already secured the place. We're putting a lot of money into really fixing it up beautifully. It's a pretty big storefront, and it'll hold at least 100 people. And one of my goals is to have film openings there, to have, you know, when a film has a big opening. But how many films are at King & Crenshaw where all 100 people in the room were organizers, you know, from mainly the Black and Latino community, but people all over L.A. to make, you know, Magic Johnson's done some good things, Pan-African Film Festival. But often there are filmmakers who would love, whether it's, you know, Foodville Station or things like that, to have more community-based film showings. It's going to be an organizing office. But if you're interested, info at the Strategy Center. You can tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks. And you're listening to Gareth Stewart. Talk a couple about the films that I... Did you see any of the films?
I will. One small thing. By the way, I want to say, that series sounds good. You could turn that into a brand, and you could make that a stop that people want to make if you have you do an interesting production, not that expensive. Before we
talk
about...
And we'd love to talk to... If you're out there and you know a lot about film festivals and how to help us, info at the Strategy Center or Eric... Add Voices from the Front Lines, and Gary will give me some good advice.
I'll talk to you about it, too. Before we talk about two of the four I saw, I want to kind of challenge your audience. Maybe they don't need this challenge. I hope they don't. But and did you see the movie Dope this summer? Dope was – everybody talked about Boys in the Hood, and isn't it great people are coming out and seeing a black film and white people are doing it. This terrific film about three high school kids in Inglewood. It was like a cross between Boys in the Hood and Friday. They were – it wasn't – you know, they were dealing with their three sort of academic, quote, self-described black nerds in it who were trying to get through high school and living in Inglewood and kind of navigating the problems in that neighborhood, not demeaning it, not glorifying it. It's a bit of a comedy. It isn't as heavy as that. It doesn't ignore some of the roadblocks that are placed in that community. It has a sense of community. It's empathic even towards some of the criminals. It was a really smart film. It won a prize at Sundance. It made $14 million, so it wasn't invisible.
Pretty good,
it got
yeah.
a wide release. But where was everybody talking about? It came out in July. It wasn't limited. It didn't get a crappy little release. And where was the support for that movie?
It didn't open at the King & Crenshaw Strategy Center. That was his problem.
But I bet it played in Baldwin Hills,
I'm just kidding.
In Central.
I'm being a wise
guy. I'm saying, like, that's the kind of film you want to have.
Well, let me say what we're trying to say. I didn't mean to be cute.
Cute is good.
Yeah, cute is
good. You're adorable.
But the thing I'm trying to say is that what I'm agreeing with is we have to promote people. We have to promote, you know, when my books come out, a lot of people, I say, please help me. You know, the things don't move by themselves. When a film comes out, but that's your main challenge. We have to get behind a film, not simply go to see a film, but organized film showings.
Town crier, advocacy, evangelism,
right?
If you want it to happen. I mean, nobody was there for Ava DuVernay when Middle of Nowhere came out.
All right, well,
nobody was there, and I don't think enough people were there for Dope, so I just had to get that out.
Okay,
because
now
it isn't some little film festival thing.
Now let's
talk about your movies.
Right, now, just to say, this is Eric Mann. You're on Voices from the Front Lines. This is KPFK, 90.7 FM in Los Angeles, 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. Streaming live on the web at kpfk.org. A website. And we're going to have, Gary's going to send me an email of either his 5 or 10 favorite films or ideas, and we're going to put that up on the site besides having this whole conversation up there within 2 or 3 days. You can, again, tweet me at Eric Mann Speaks or email me, Eric at Voices from the Front Lines. Now, Gary.
Okay. Now we're going to get on topic, finally. I only saw two of the movies you mentioned. I'm seeing Mississippi Grind next week. You got to an early screening of that, I guess, because that's not released. So,
oh, yes,
pretty
it is.
Cool.
Yes.
Mississippi Grind is out. Where'd you see it?
DirecTV.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
My wife, Leanne.
Maybe I'll watch it tonight.
Yeah,
I'm excited about it.
Damn good.
The topics and the director. I didn't see The Age of Adeline because it looked tacky and it got bad reviews.
Yeah.
And those are two things that kind of dissuade me from spending my precious, you know, time. I did see Grandma. I was borderline in seeing I'll See You in My Dreams. We'll start with that. I liked both of them better than you did. I love Bly Danner, and I like that performance. I wouldn't say it's an essential movie. I think some of your critique of it is valid, but I that movie isn't as maudlin and isn't as formulaic as you say it is, and I think her performance, and even some of the way the characters are played and the way it portrays seniors and takes them seriously, it deserves a little more credit. So I wouldn't stand from the roof to say it, but the top of the roof to say see it. But I think if you are interested in it, and you like Blythe Danner, and I think you should, because I think she's one of the great actresses worth seeing.
Grandma, and the pot smoking scene was very funny.
Yeah,
that was very funny.
And I liked the relationship. I liked the way her relationship with Sam Neill was, and I liked the relationship with Martin Starr, with the pool boy.
Okay,
that was not something you see in every film, and human beings connecting. Grandma, I just loved. Again, not a great film, but a very, very good film. And I liked it for a number of reasons. You enumerated some of them, the way it looked at the culture of abortion and choice in a positive way, and even dealt with that a teeny bit in The Protester.
Yeah, yeah.
And also very matter-of-factly looked at it in an intergenerational way, and, you know, and didn't turn it into a moral quandary, turned it into she made the decision,
that's
the
right.
grandmother's
going
to help her.
That's exactly right.
It, you know, it was somebody that had come from a background of sort of 60s radicalism and feminism and was unapologetic about it. And wasn't it great to see Lily Tomlin just, you know, I thought she was sexy, and I thought she was just, you know, there was no, like, you weren't thinking, oh, she's an older person. You were thinking, this is a character. This is a character that, rather than being frail and calm, was somebody that had all this wisdom and not afraid to be a warrior and not afraid to be tough and not afraid to kind of go for it while screwing up every now and then. Also, a little bit of class politics in that. Far from a, you know, a low-income story, but here's somebody struggling to say, I'm going to have a hard time getting $600 for an abortion. And it's a white person doing that. I thought that was interesting. I agree the Marcia Gay Harden character could have been fleshed out a little better, but I thought the film was under 90 minutes. It was an hour and 20 minutes. It moved really quickly. Almost every character in it had a strong sense of character. It was about somebody who grew up with ideas and beliefs and struggles and politics, and politics were running through it on many levels.
I agree. I mean, as I said,
it is,
I liked the film a lot. Since I'm one of those older people, and I think I'm really handsome, and my wife is gorgeous.
You're hot.
No, I mean, yeah. I mean, I'm shocked when people go, oh, my God, she looks so great at 65 or 70. Hey, let me break it to you, folks. There's a lot of gorgeous, gorgeous people out there. And I thought that's what I was trying to say, that Blythe Danner is perceived to be the beauty. I thought Lily Tomlin looked gorgeous. I mean, just the normal face, just that, I mean, for me, the compelling nature of her on the screen, I liked her more than the film, but I mean, it was a, but the main point is, yes, folks, of all the films, I would definitely go see this. Also support it, because it is the kind of women's film we haven't, you know, besides a white people's film. It's a real feminist film, and it's got some really nice stuff. Plus, I didn't mention, she's got a black tattoo friend. And who was the Latino who just died, who was in the film? It wasn't Rosie Perez, was it?
No, it was Elizabeth Peña.
I'm sorry.
It was a terrific actor.
Yes,
I was so shocked to see her, because she passed away
some time ago.
By the way, I think that's somebody that was far from invisible. That's somebody that deserved a far more prominent
career.
Totally agree. If you see any of her work from Down and Out in Beverly Hills,
Elizabeth Peña,
like, you know, deserved to be a powerful person, a sex symbol, a box office star like that. And the next version of her, I think, will be if things get better.
So those are the two you've seen. And you're on KPFK 90.7 FM. Mm-hmm. This is Eric Mann with Gary Stewart. And we've gone through the two films that we've seen. I just want to end with a couple of thoughts and give Gary a few thoughts. And if you have, send me a tweet at Eric Mann Speaks. I'll read it, but I haven't got a ton of you, so I'll just keep talking to Gary. One of the things I'm struck by is I spend my life in movements where I find the stuff fascinating. I find there's plenty of drama. I mean, it's this sort of a personal thing where I was going to be an actor. You know, that was what I wanted to be. I was in summer stock, and I could have been a contender, you know, but I felt like, truly, I want to be an actor on a bigger stage. The civil rights movement was far more compelling than being an actor. But I think it's very hard for filmmakers to make movements come alive. I think Norma Rae is a great film, a truly great film, Obviously, Battle of Algiers, and we can go through them. La Guerre Finie, Dry White Season. And in respect, again, back to Selma, what they did to make a film about a movement. I wish we had 12 movement films we could critique. You know what I'm saying?
Suffragette's coming out.
Okay, good.
Okay, let's put that on the docket.
All right. And I'm going to get on the show is, the new Black Panther film, the
documentary.
The documentary. All right, Gary, tell us your last thoughts about anything from global warming to Rhino Records.
Well, I want to rave to people about, I'm not as deep as you. I want to rave to people about going to see certain films. You talked about Dinner with Andre. You want to see a film with conversation. I love The End of the Tour, the film about David Limsky writing the article on David Foster Wallace. It's a two-hour conversation. It's fascinating. Best of Enemies, the film about Gore Vidal going at it with William F. Buckley.
And I just got the Here Comes the Sun. So, gee, thanks a whole lot.
Thanks for having me. It's
Gary,
always a blast.
And Channing Martinez, you're amazing. You're really, really doing a tremendous job for us. Hey, KPFK, hang in there, folks. We still don't have enough money. Gary, you're always a lot of fun. And everybody, I'll see you next Tuesday, guess what? Robin D.G. Kelly's coming in studio. We're going to talk about his amazing book, Hammer and Hoe, about the Alabama Communist Party in the 30s for a full hour with Robin in studio. Again, Gary, so much. Thank you, G. Bye, everybody. And as I say, it may get old, but it's still true. All power to the people.